Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner. I'm a programmer at TIFF now, and this is The Other Thing I Do. My guest this week is Sarah Weisglass, an actor you may have seen in Mary Goes Round, Ginny and Georgia, October Faction, Killjoys, or Cascade, among other films and television series. Most recently, she co-starred with Michaela Watkins and Charlie Gillespie in Dane Clark and Lindsay Stewart's midlife comedy Suits, which is available on digital and on demand as of today. So here she is. Sarah picked Promising Young Woman, Emerald Fennell's Oscar-winning 2020 feature starring Carey Mulligan as Cassie, a former medical student who's thrown away her future to spend her days working in a coffee shop and her nights pretending to get drunk at clubs so she can go home with the men who want to take advantage of her, all in the name of avenging another woman. Until she meets Ryan, played by Bo Burnham, who seems like a really nice guy and might even offer her a way forward. But, well, it's complicated. In a lot of ways. This is someone else's movie.
God, this is going to be tough because I love it, but I've only seen it twice. So it's like, I want to make sure that I don't spoil it for anyone, but also that I give it its due diligence.
It's a four-year-old movie. I think you're, three and a half. I think you're cool spoiler. To talk about the spoilers. And you can't really talk about the film without talking about the structure. So
yeah,
we'll get there.
Okay. I chose Promising Young Woman because I think it's one of the smartest films I've seen in a really long time. It surprised me. It kind of shook me to my core. And I think it's kind of meta in the sense that Emerald Fennell was very strategic in how she cast this movie. For those who don't know, Promising Young Woman is about a 30-year-old woman who lost her best friend. And her best friend went through some serious trauma involving sexual assault. And so she's kind of taken on this avenger kind of role for her friend and goes to all these people who played a part in that sexual assault and kind of, I don't want to say tortures them with it, but she kind of does.
Yeah. Like her mission as we see it, because it's not quite, I mean, that's the thing that, it bugs me a little bit about the resolution, and we can get there. Same thing.
A lot of people had a hard time with it, and I just read a couple reviews on it too, and so I do understand. But I mean, for me, like, I just loved it.
No, if it landed, it landed. That's totally fine. The same thing happened. I found with Saltburn though, where Fennell just needs to run through the script with a highlighter and make sure we didn't miss anything.
Yeah,
which I guess.
I just love a good puzzle. I love when the answers aren't given to you. I like when writers don't assume that their audience is dumb and they actually assume that, you know, we can figure things out. And I think that's something that she does quite brilliantly. But yeah, again, I think like one of the main parts of this film is the whole like nice guy narrative and like how, you know, not all men, but also a lot of men. Like, it's just a very interesting conversation. And I'm really happy that she kind of put it together in the way she did. So like, for example, she chose a lot of the men in the film who are supposed to be like, you know, the good guys. She chose like, you know, Adam Brody and Max Greenfield, who are like very well known for playing these like lovable, quirky, like characters that we love on screen and characters that we feel safe with and actors that we feel safe with. And then she just makes them, you know, really predatorial and very scary. And it's like, I don't know. I think that was used so to her advantage because it made my stomach hurt. Like I am like the biggest Bo Burnham fan and like watching this film and then like what ends up happening, I was just like gutted. And it's the same way that you're gutted in real life when you find out that someone you know is, you know, not as great a person and the complications that come with that. And I just feel like it's a really sensitive topic that she covered with absolute, like, I don't even know the words to use. Like, I just think she just did such an incredible job.
Yeah. The use of the actors as sort of dark mirrors of themselves, or is almost like camouflage traps. I don't know how to explain it either, but the idea that you're watching, you know, Schmidt from New Girl rip off the mask and be a complete monster. Like he's pretty much the worst. He doesn't actually kill anybody, but he facilitates so much more. Yeah. And Sam Richardson, the sweetest man in the world. And it's great. It's really clever casting. And you can also feel that all the actors get it and are there for it. Like they want to the chance to show the side of themselves. And they're sort of allowing that perversion of their image to be used in this project.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, like Carey Mulligan is doing it too. She's being cast as someone pretending to be much harder than she is. Right. Mm-hmm. Because the vulnerability underneath Cassie and the reasoning that she employs and the purpose, like the genesis of her mission, as we find out more and more about her, Mulligan is revealing Cassie to be someone who's trying so hard to be dead inside and isn't.
And yes. Oh, that's brilliant. Yes. Brilliantly put.
It's a great performance, right? And the film creates the context for it that makes perfect sense. To the point where I saw this in, I think it was February of 2020, right after Sundance, when it was supposed to come out in April, before the pandemic shut everything down. So it went away, didn't get released till Christmas Day, which again, charming,
weird.
Nice,
yeah.
Marketing.
I mean, weird with me released on Christmas.
Yeah. Smart for awards though. And, it worked. It worked on Focus's behalf, but it gave me some like 8 months to percolate with the film and think about it when it came back again. So I watched it a second time just before it opened so I could write the review. And it's like, oh yeah, these pieces separately work individually, very powerful scenes. I'm not sure they all add up the way Fennell wants them to, but the message is there, right? Like it's the execution might be a little wobbly and we can talk about that. And if it worked for you, then it worked for you and it's irrelevant, right? Because if you come out of the theater with the impact of it, it's just, The scene that, I'll get this out of the way right up front, the scene that I don't fully think works is the thesis statement. If Cassie is trying to demonstrate that, and we can spoil this because, I mean, anybody listening to this will hopefully know. If Cassie is trying to demonstrate that all men will be awful if given the opportunity, which is ultimately the whole point of the third act, the fact that she hasn't actually been attacking people, like the reveal that she hasn't been doing anything other than, you know, a stern warning, doesn't make sense.
It's true,
right? Like the guy who honks at her when she's having her breakdown and she gets out of the car with the tire iron and smashes his windows, she is inciting, I think Mulligan is playing it as, you know, a dare. She is hoping that she'll be proven right, that this guy can attack her because she's armed and she should beat the shit out of him. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't. He drives away. It's a not all men moment. And I don't know that the movie knows that.
That's a good point. Yeah, I forgot about that scene.
It's weird, right?
I think the thing that I kind of carried me as a through line is this whole portrayal of female rage. And I think, you know, in some films, there's like the over the top screaming, exploding with anger. And then there's the soft, like just stewing anger. And it comes off as iciness and coldness. But like, I just thought that was so masterful. And I think that that's one moment where she does kind of let that rage out. And I like that, you know, he kind of runs away so she doesn't get to finish that. Because like often women aren't allowed to be angry. And that I thought was like kind of like a tongue in cheek, like interesting moment.
Okay.
I think the ending, the thing that a lot of people didn't understand is if Cassie's, you know, trying to get justice for her friend and she ends up dying. And then this man goes to prison, not for her friend's rape, but for killing someone, like, it's like, where's the justice in that? And like, where, like, and also it's a small town, like, and what he goes to jail for, like, it could be argued as self-defense because she literally tied him to a bed and like threatened to cut him open. So that I think totally makes sense why people wouldn't get it. But I love the smartness of going in with a plan and knowing, like, loving her friend so much that she knows that what she's doing is very dangerous. And she goes in anyway, and she has a full plan, knowing that if she does lose her life, that there is like going to be a way for all of this to finally pay off and work out. But yeah, very uncomfortable that 8 minute scene of Cass dying.
Oh, the whole final. Yeah. It's, and again, Mulligan plays it with that kind of release that doesn't make sense until you understand what the plan was, which makes it work emotionally, if not fully logically. Cause yeah, as you mentioned, it's entrapment in a bunch of ways. But of course we also know, and that's the other thing too, the whole plan relies on the police to protect her. after her death.
The police didn't even protect Nina. Yeah.
I mean, maybe it's designed to expose them to somehow, and just that was a line that got cut or something. Mm-hmm. But what you feel, what I felt the second time through was just this sense of just the loss of this woman's life. The sense that I'm on her parents' side all of a sudden. It's like, well, you had such great promise. You had such, I mean, obviously it's the title, but you had a future and you threw it all away. And then we realized, no, it's happening now. We're watching it now. That's what's happening. And that's really powerful. And Mulligan, again, has this fundamental dignity, this commitment into it, that is the thing that I think pushes the movie past the logistical questions that I might have. And I realize I just spent 2 minutes mansplaining the midsection of the movie to you, and I apologize. But like, the machinery of the plot is less important than the emotional impact. That's what I'm getting here too. That's totally how it felt with me. It's like, I can't fully discount this movie, and I agree with everything it's saying. I think without Mulligan, and it is like, that's the reason you cast someone that good. Without Mulligan, it's a very different film, and maybe not a good one, or maybe not as successful.
You know, did you hear about all the controversy with, I think it was it Variety magazine issued an apology?
That was dumb. That was as a journalist at the time, I was embarrassed for Variety. You know, I was able to review it without making it weird and personal. And just sometimes, yeah, it's a teachable moment, right? If you're willing to learn, but I don't know that they always are.
Yeah. I think another thing that popped up while you were speaking is we're watching Cass's loss of life in real time. Mm-hmm. I mean, she lost her life just as much as Nina did back in when that happened. And so I feel like, you know, every bit of her plan is kind of like her trying to reclaim her life. And then when she eventually falls for, I don't know what his name is in the movie, but Bo Burnham's character, I think she starts to realize that that's not the only way to live again. And that's why it makes it, I think if Bo ended up being a good person and Bo ended up being like wonderful, I don't know if Cassie would have gone and done that.
No, I agree. I think seeing Ryan in the video is enough to send her spiraling, because he is, and again, right? Like, that was years ago, and maybe he is a better person now, but she won't, like, seeing the video is enough to just bring that door down, and she won't allow it. And that's,
because then what, like, that would make her just like everyone else around that whole night. I mean, like, the amount of people that, you know, didn't believe Nina, and the people who were like, oh, but Al was my friend and he's a good guy. It's like, if she kind of forgave him for that, then like, she has no leg to stand on.
Yeah.
So I thought that was also something really brilliant to discuss.
Yeah. No, I mean, Mulligan plays that too, right? Like, it's not disillusionment. It's the understanding that she has to recommit. Like, she's going forward with the mission. It's almost like a war picture, right? Like, this is the last push over the hill, and she has to get through it. And it's awful because we like who she is with Ryan. Like, she likes who she is with Ryan.
Oh my God, she's so cute. She's so cute and soft and like happy.
Yeah. You see the person she could have been. You see the person she used to be. Mm-hmm. And then she forged herself into this other thing, which has no mercy, she has mercy, which is the problem, right? Like, she allows herself to let people off the hook. And then Ryan is the thing that she can't, he's the one she can't let go. Mm-hmm. And it's, and Bo Burnham is, I've met him. He's very tall. They play with that. I guess it was when Eighth Grade came out, so a couple of years before. And he's, what you don't get is a sense of how physically intimidating, well, imposing. He's lanky. He's like 6'6". He's huge. Yeah. It's like the contrast in Priscilla with Jacob Elordi and Kaylee Spani. They're the same age, which is wrong, because Elvis was 10 years older than Priscilla, but he towers over her, and that instantly, you know, you get the power dynamic visually instantly. Here they sort of cheat it so that you don't get a sense of it, which is, I mean, it's the right call, because if he did loom over her, then the turn wouldn't work as easily. We have to be genuinely shocked that this harmless, charming guy is not, like, or wasn't And it doesn't matter if he's made efforts to better himself, right? That's the horrible thing that you see on Mulligan's face is there's no dialogue about it. She just ghosts him because it's the thing that it's the validation of her, like her greatest fear that she can't trust anybody. And you mentioned the casting, which is so great of gentle, soft guys as potential villains, but also the smart casting of Clancy Brown is the most empathetic dad, right? Like he's the Kurgan from Highlander. He's a villain all the time. And Fennel casts him as someone who just doesn't want his daughter to be sad anymore. And you feel the heartbreak. And that's the thing I took away from the end of the movie. It's like, oh, they're never going to get over this, mm-hmm. which is her point. But she's not the only one whose life is destroyed. I mean, Nina was the inciting incident, but this chain reaction is going to keep on rippling and it's just awful.
And even Nina's mom, Molly Shannon, like sitting down and being like, please let it go. Cause you're like harming everyone. Like, I just think that was also so important as a moment because it was like, it was a very obvious moment that showed just how alone Cassie was in this mission. And her not being able to trust anyone. And also I think the decision to not show the like assault was also brilliant. Even when we're hearing the video, like it kind of plays on the fact that like you hear about certain stories and you don't know whether to believe them or not. And like, it's just, I loved how many real life kind of, mechanisms were drawn out because of the way that this movie was written. And like, she played on all of our fears. And especially like as a woman, one of my favorite lines in that whole thing is when he's like, what is it? He's like, it's when she's tied him up. She's tied Al up and she's like, makes some kind of comment about him assaulting Nina. And he's like, no, like allegations like that are like the worst thing for a man. Like it's our worst fear. And she's like, can you imagine what a woman's greatest fear is? It's like so poetic and perfect. And yeah, I think that movie just like really changed a lot for me. And I, again, like I really love how Emerald kind of like used our real life, like dialogue with one another in our real life, like pop culture understanding to kind of like reinforce the story with the casting and with like certain kind of tools like that. I think she's brilliant.
Yeah. I was really interesting watching the critical split too, between people who embraced the message and understood what the film is trying to do and people who treated it as like a Sundance shock horror kind of thing, like the hot button stabbing of an idea over and over and over again. There were a couple of reviews that really struck me as just willfully ignorant, refusing to engage with the movie. And the sense that after Me Too, after the year that we had in 2020, the idea that people could still willfully ignore and just refuse to engage with the idea of a film like this. And to fall back, I'm sure one, I can't remember who it was, but it was jarring to read one of the reviews written by a guy who said, you know, like, I can't conceive of this playing out in reality, which is very different from me saying, I have a plot question. Yeah. Right? Like he absolutely denies the possibility that these things happen, that any of these things could happen. And I think it was because he was irritated with the way that Fennel presents the courtship of Cassie and Ryan, which is like bright colors and sitcom-y repartee, and they meet cute and they have fun spitting at each other. Like, it's adorable.
Yeah.
But it's there because that coexists. Like, that's the whole point, right? Like it's what you said. It's the woman's worst fear. It's the Margaret Atwood line about, you know, men are afraid women will laugh at them. Women are afraid men will kill them. It's all there. Like he wants her to laugh at him or with him. And that line that they run, like flirting can feel like a threat sometimes. If you're trying to build intimacy with someone, you have to be vulnerable, and vulnerability is not. Have you seen Woman of the Year, by the way, Anna Kendrick's movie?
No, I've not.
We played it at the festival. It's really good.
Is that the one about an abusive relationship?
No. Well, I mean, maybe. No. Oh no. Sorry. That's Ellie Darling. No.
Yeah. Something like that. I auditioned Alice for that Darling. One.
Oh really?
Yeah. That's why I was like, oh my God, are we about to talk about something I could have been in? But continue. Woman of the Year.
This is the movie she made next, and it feels very much like a project in line with Alice Darling. It's about, I can't remember his name. It's about the serial killer who went on the dating game and the woman who picked him as bachelor number three. And she plays the woman. And it's intercut with his murders, with the other women.
Whoa.
The women that he killed. And the original title was The Dating Game, which is so, I mean, it's got at least three meanings. And it's beautiful. It's a great title. But the film is so perceptive. And it's like the execution of the subtext of Promising Young Woman. But set in the 70s when there was no awareness, when there was like, it was simply accepted that a man could get handsy around a woman's neck and that would be okay. Like, it was just horrible. And she directed it and it's really good. Netflix bought it, so it should be showing up fairly soon. But it's a knockout. And
I'll put that on my list.
Yeah, keep an eye out for it because it articulates all the things that are floating around in Promising Young Woman. But like 3 years later, it was the first film I'd seen that really picks up that ball and runs with it. But Fennell is the one who did the kickoff. That's a terrible metaphor, but yeah, it's the kind of thing that goes off like a grenade in pop culture. And you know, the memeable stuff, the cello cover of Toxic and putting on makeup in slow motion, staring into a mirror, all that stuff. I mean, those are elements from horror movies, which this is, but in a really distressingly
real,
commercial, brightly lit way, right?
Like, yeah,
it's real because there are no monsters. Like, how many movies are there about a young woman who's initiated into a secret society of werewolves or vampires or something, or finds out that she's dinner? You know, like there's one called The Inheritance, I think, that came out a couple of years ago, like after Promising Young Woman. It's just like, oh, this is the same movie. It just has vampires so you can get out of jail. Without the supernatural, without the fantastical, if it's just like malice and if it's society is the monster, that kind of thing. Like, it's a really simple explanation, but it's much more unnerving if there's nothing to drive a stake into.
Yeah. I think that's the most uncomfortable part, is like you leave knowing that this is not something you can fix and that it is too big a problem and too embedded in society that no matter how badly you want to change it, you cannot do it alone. You can do your part. You can share your thoughts. You can have conversations, but like, this is literally a problem that is too deep rooted in our world. And like, it's you feel very hopeless leaving the theater, 'cause you're like, you feel like you're up against this huge demon. And I think that's part of the genius of it, because then you do start to talk about it and you do start to, like, that's how you get out that emotion of hopelessness, is being like, you guys feel this too, right? And then, you know, hopefully the more conversations get, you know, like, happen, then the closer we get to like creating a semi-safe world. But like, man, it's just, I thought it was such a powerful portrayal of, you know, like I haven't really seen many like rape revenge, like heroin, like films like this. And so I'm sure that's part of the reason why it like really struck me. But I just loved all these, like you said, the light colors when she's falling in love, the like contrasty, scary, colorful candy stripper outfit. Like, I thought all of it was just so magical in telling such a very honest, truthful story. Like, something so sad, but it does happen a lot.
Hey, it's Norm interrupting my own show to bring you up to speed on Shiny Things, my newsletter about physical media, culture, and the odd streaming project. Last week was a little quiet, though I did take a look at some encouraging new coverage of people returning to collecting discs rather than finding their entertainment on increasingly unreliable streaming services. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at shiny-things.ghost.io or find a link at the Semcast Blue Sky account. You like reading about movies, I like writing about them. Come check it out. There's something in that, right? Like, the fact that everybody knows a version of that story going into the theater, and we're just seeing the you know, the third act extrapolated out into like a spectacular level. And the other thing that I heard from a lot of the other thing that was really striking, the thing I wanted to mention is the fact that this came out in December 2020, theaters were still closed, and a lot of, like, Canada didn't have any, I think, or at least Ontario didn't, and everybody had to see it individually. Like, everybody watched it alone, and I find, or with one or two people, and I find that really interesting, because I still don't know. I saw it with maybe 15 critics, and we tend to sit very quietly. I don't know how this plays with an audience, and I wish I could have seen that, had that experience of seeing it at Sundance, and just, so what was your experience? Did you see it, like, just...
I actually remember it's the only movie I've ever, like, after finishing it, I genuinely texted like 10 people to be like, have you seen this movie? Can we talk about it? Because I just had so many like feelings about it that I was just like, I need someone to share this with. And I did watch it completely alone. So I think I posted on my Instagram story, but like privately, like to my close friends being like, who's watched this movie? Who can go out for coffee with me so we can discuss this? Because it just was like, heavy. But yeah, I'm so glad. Like, there was a time in 2020 where people were like, oh, I don't think movie theaters are going to survive this. And I was so upset, because like, that was me and my family's favorite thing to do, is like just go see movies together. And so I'm so glad that they survived that. But yeah, I think that's a very good point, that everyone had to watch this alone and kind of sit with their own feelings about it, which is pretty important.
Yeah, I also saw Saltburn on my own, because I had to watch a screener for awards consideration. And I understand that one just gets weird bursts of applause at different places, wherever it plays. Have you seen it? You're nodding.
I have. So I watched it with my boyfriend and my friend, and it was a weird night. We were constantly like, what is this? What is going on here? But like I said, I love a good puzzle movie. And like that one little sequence of like showing everything Oliver did to make all of this happen, I was like, that's freaking genius. And even that last scene, Murder on the Dance Floor playing, like, thought it was a pretty wicked way to like tie everything up.
Yeah. It's the opposite lesson from Promising Young Woman, right? Like, give the audience the thing they want the most. Mm-hmm. The thing that came out wrong, but it's like, she's learned that Promising Young Woman is a downbeat crowd pleaser in a weird way, right? Because it validates the worst expectations in a way that is still commercial somehow and gets the message out. Saltburn is just like, rich people deserved it, which I don't have a problem with that. But it's a weird place to be as a sort of a hot button storyteller in a way. Fennell's sort of carved this position for herself now where I don't know what the next thing is, but it has to be like even more provocative and transgressive.
Just keeps like coming up with new ways to just absolutely freak us out and simultaneously like kind of validate us in a way. Like, it's just, I think she's very smart. I would love to work with her someday. So Fennell, if you're listening, please. Hire me.
I mean, I could see that. I kind of want to see her try an actual genre project next, because she's played with it. Like, there's this whole genre adjacent thing going on in both of her movies where they're, you know, outwardly respectable, but inwardly they're just like, Promising Young Woman is not so far from I Spit on Your Grave, right? Those, the rape revenge movies that cycles from the 70s that you're talking about, or even just the full-on revenge movies like The Last House on the Left, which was itself a remake of The Virgin Spring, the Bergman film, which always weirds me out. But I think that's the power of it. Like, there's something really primal about the stories that she's telling. If Saltburn is just desire and class, that's fine. Everybody can relate to that on some level. But Promising Young Woman is about righting a wrong that can't be righted. Like, it's about what it costs to get justice.
And that justice really is not something that exists.
Yeah. Because that's all of it, right? Like, Cassie can't be sure. She can't be sure of anything, as it turns out. She can't be sure that her boyfriend is a good person, but she can't be sure that the plan will work. She can't be sure. She knows that it's justified. Like, she knows she has the right people, but everything else is a high wire act. Like, what if those texts don't go out? There's a million different things that could...
Another, like, incredible choice is that she left the bulk of that ending up to the lawyer who represented Al. And so she actually, I think that's where, in my opinion, her whole journey is validated, because there was once this, you know, lawyer who his whole job was letting people like this go back into the world and letting horrible, like helping horrible people escape like blame and justice. And here she is trusting that after having this conversation where he is showing true remorse, leaving it all to him. And like, that's her final act of like that's trusting a man, which is not something that she does lightly. And so I feel like that is a very validating moment for her and also for the audience to just see, like, she did, like, Cass did change.
Yeah.
Over the course of, like, I don't know if, like, I don't think she would have done that. Like, she even had someone ready to go beat the shit out of this guy. But then she, like, listened and stopped and, like, felt, which is also not something that I think she wanted to do.
Yeah.
I think it's very poetic that that's how, that she left it all in the hands of someone who had once wronged, but was dedicated to doing the right thing.
And who, again, is somebody, Alfred Molina, most people will know from playing a bad guy, right? Although he was the bad guy with heart in the Spider-Man movies. Doc Ock had a soul. But yeah, it's funny. I hadn't even considered the fact that he wouldn't go through with it, because Alfred Molina gives you such compassion in that scene and such presence and commitment that, like, he's somebody I always instinctively trust as an actor to follow through with the concepts, because he's just this effortless character actor who can inhabit anything. But here he's just sad. Like, he's sad and he's sorry in a way that I don't know that I'd seen before in a movie.
Yeah. And I think that actually made me uncomfortable, because I didn't know if I believed it. And when she was like, "I forgive you," and cried, I was like, does she? Like, this is crazy. Like, it just is so layered and so complicated that you were just like on the edge of your seat the whole time. You're like, I don't know who to believe and I don't know who to root for.
Yeah. Well, and even if she's playing him, she has to, right, for the plan. So it's one of those things, it doesn't need a flashback. It's sort of, it's established that, yep, that's what she's been doing. She'll do whatever she has to do. But I do think it's genuine, because Mulligan shows something else in Cassie in that scene. And again, you just like, I guess it's the same with Saltburn. Without the cast, without the level of talent assembled, the people who want to work with Emerald Fennell, you don't get this effect. You can get, you know, we've all seen movies where the script is pretty interesting, but something doesn't work. I just watched the Coens Burn After Reading again last night, and I still hate it. I hate it. It's not funny. Nothing in it is funny. Everything lands flat. And other people love it because they just like watching these actors run around being goofs. But the two sides never connect. The spark doesn't catch fire. And Promising Young Woman and Saltburn do have this compulsive watchability to see what they're going to do next, because you're invested in the people.
What was your reaction to the bathtub scene in Saltburn?
You know, honestly, I kind of saw it coming.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, no pun intended. It's like, it kind of has to go there, right? Like, it's how it catalyzes the obsession. And we already know that Oliver is so into this man. Although weirdly enough, it's the one scene, like the one in, like, the, and it comes right around the same point in the movie too, like in Promising Young Woman. It's the one scene that doesn't make sense if you believe this whole thing was calculated. Mm-hmm. It's just like, maybe he's surrendering to impulse and giving in because he's so far embedded that it wouldn't matter. But it's the one time that the real risk is illogical, that doing what he's doing doesn't make sense if he has a master plan. But it's a, you know, like, it's this, the scene everybody talks about, so you get away with it. Like, it doesn't matter. What did Billy Wilder say? All you need for a movie is three good scenes and no bad ones. Like, just one really memorable moment is enough in this case to just, you know, like, it's the thing everybody was talking about for a week.
That's true. Yeah. And it's been very memeified, and a lot has come from it. But yeah, I think that's one that's funny, that's another one people have had to watch on their own and not in a theater. I don't think it's available in theaters, is it?
It was out for a couple of weeks, but it's mostly an Amazon thing. They did like a, maybe even not even a week, just like at the 18th to the 25th or something before it came out on Prime.
Is that just so that it could have
like awards consideration? Yeah.
Nice. Because that does seem like a weird one that you would go watch with everybody. And I feel like everyone walking out of that theater would be like, what did we just see?
Yeah. We'll agree not to discuss it. Yeah. Just a lot of people walking out looking straight ahead at the popcorn stand.
Being like, yeah, that was an interesting one. Yeah. I actually didn't know it was Emerald until like the very end. And then I was like, oh, and it kind of changed shit for me because I was like, whoa. And I just fucking love her.
Nice. The giveaway on, seeing Carey Mulligan show up as poor Pamela, that wasn't a giveaway?
No, it wasn't. It was not. And now looking back, that seems pretty silly of me.
Poor dear Pamela.
Yeah.
I think. She's actually billed that way, which seems just mean. But it's like, again, this is somebody who gets, who forges creative partnerships and people will just show up in her movie for 5 minutes to just hang out, I think, to be part of it. And along those lines, we also, like, I keep forgetting to credit Margot Robbie because her production company produced Promising Young Woman, picked it up in like 2017 or something.
That's what that Variety article, what the guy wrote, he was like, this should have been Margot Robbie. It would have been a lot better. And I just like completely, I mean, Margot's fantastic and I'd watch anything she's in, but like, I really loved Carrie's portrayal and like Carrie's performance. I think it was like icy. And yeah. I don't know if it was the kind of icy that Margot Robbie would be able, like, she wouldn't be able to kind of find that same level.
She has a different presence, right? Like yeah. Carrie Mulligan, and I think that was the thrust, now that you mentioned it, the thrust of the Variety piece was that Carrie Mulligan wasn't attractive enough to pull it off, right? Which was so weird because A, go fuck yourself. That's not appropriate as a journalist. B, Mulligan's character is actively repelling most people. Like she's faking, the whole point is that she's faking her interest in people. So it doesn't matter how literally or physically attractive you find her as a viewer. They do. And yeah, ew. It's just, no, I don't appreciate it. Also, I'm sorry, I swore at you.
That's okay.
But I swore over your shoulder.
I've almost said fuck 8 times and I'm like, oh, am I allowed?
You're allowed.
I'm glad that that's out in the open now.
We have the little warning. But yeah, no, it's like, it is such a weird thing. And Margot Robbie, I'm sure she could have done it. I have no problem believing it.
Biggest Margot Robbie fan. I'm sure she could have. I just think it would have been a different movie.
Very much so. Yeah. And Mulligan has the hardness or is capable of pulling it out in a way that Robbie isn't. It's like
and I'm like a little scared of her, which yeah. I don't know if I'm scared of Margot.
Yeah, it's funny. When Margot Robbie does something bordering on violence, I mean, I'm thinking of the Suicide Squad movies or, you know, Harley Quinn or whatever. When she's doing that, she is letting us in on the joke of the mm-hmm. violence. And mm-hmm. I've seen her play like a more conventional, not an antagonist, but a violent character. And I don't know. I just don't know if I buy it. And maybe the best thing about Margot Robbie as an actor is that she knew Carey Mulligan would have a different take.
Yeah.
And, you know, like not a better or worse one, just that, no, this is the person to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Man, this movie, I like want to watch it a third time. Like, there's just so much in it to go off of and to just write about and explore. I just think it's one of the good ones.
That's a good ending, except that I still want to talk about Suze. And how you,
fine.
Or not even Suze, but just all the other things. Like, I'm trying to figure out, we were kidding before we started recording that there's got to be I was trying to find a way to loop Promising Young Woman back into something you've done, but it's not really that easy.
It's far from, yeah. It's a very different, genre. It's a very different tone. But I will say, like, the one connection I could find is the female rage. Because, I mean, at least for my character in Suze, I think she's very angry. And I think both her boyfriend and her mother have put these unrealistic standards on her and have kind of made fantasies about her and that she is responsible for their happiness. And that is so unfair to put on anyone, let alone a fucking 17-year-old girl. So I think her anger and her like bitchiness towards her mom and towards her boyfriend, I think all of that is just really displaced anger and fear. And I think she doesn't want to end up the way that her mom did. I think she's a child of divorce. So I think she wants to get out of this town and she wants to leave and she wants to be far from. So I think that's the only connection I can really find.
You find a much more harmless spin on it in that, you know, she's not going to lash out and hurt someone. or herself. Mm-hmm. Like she's sort of, my take on the movie is that they bring you in when they need to make people remember that, you know, this not to take everything so seriously, because you come in and explode like a fireball of comedy and she's angry, but she's angry in an inarticulate way that is funny. I think that I really kind of enjoyed watching, because it is potentially a big, heavy movie, right? Like this is a story about a woman who takes in someone who's just tried to harm himself and really just grudgingly. And the bond that happens is almost an accident because neither of them really wants, I mean, I think he does. He desperately needs someone to be. Yeah. But it has limits, right? And that story can only progress in one of two directions. And thankfully, the movie finds the more interesting one rather than the cringy, obvious one. And when you show up, you get to go, what? And turn it and try to make it about her again, which is really fun.
Yeah, I think one of the first conversations I remember having with Dane and Lindsay, who wrote and directed it, is they were like, we know that Brooke is written a certain surface way, but we really don't want her to be like that. So like whatever we can find to kind of like add layers to this and kind of make it more interesting, like, and then we had all these talks about like what it must be like to have that pressure on you and to have someone dote on you and kind of like expect everything from you and like you're their only hope. And like I really connected to that. I thought that was so interesting and it made so much sense why she would want to leave and why she would want to get out. And like I just found a lot more compassion for her after that talk. But yeah, I mean, I love this project. I love this script. I thought it was so funny. I was laughing out loud when I was reading it on a plane. Like it was, and I know Charlie. We met, like, he was my first friend in LA when I went to pilot season for the first time.
Oh yeah.
And then Michaela, I've looked up to for over 10 years. Like just, I watched her on SNL and I've loved everything she's done. And I just getting to play her daughter felt so full circle for me. And it was just really magical getting to watch both of them because they both bring such different energy to the table. Cause Michaela's very dry humor, like, but like very relatable, kind of voicing our inner awkwardness and our inner, like, just like nervousness. And I think that's very like beautifully captured. And then you have Charlie, who is just like absolutely like a firecracker of energy and just like bashful, oafy, like, he's just so funny. And they both just gave so much. So getting to work with them and getting to, you know, see them work even was just like a real masterclass for me. Like I just had like the best time.
I can imagine. It's, yeah, watching the two of them together, it's like watching a really serious dog trainer try to work with a golden doodle. It just 100%. Isn't happening. And then you get to come in as the owner and say, what? He's still doing the thing I don't want him to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's really something. I can't wait for people to see it. I think this is going to be one of those ones that people really just leave and they're like, have you seen this? It's actually so funny. Like, I just feel like it's going to have a good response. And that makes me happy.
And nobody sacrifices themselves for the greater good.
And no one dies. Right?
Oh yeah. I don't think so.
No one dies. Woo. For a second, I was like, oh my God.
My thanks to Sarah Weisglass, who you can see opposite Michaela Watkins and Charlie Gillespie in Suze, available on digital and on demand right now. And you should also check her out in the thriller Cascade, now streaming on Netflix in Canada. Thanks also to Angie Power. She knows what she did. You can find Sarah on Instagram at Sarah Wise, all one word, S-A-R-A-W-A-I-S. And you can find Promising Young Woman on 4K Blu-ray and DVD from Universal Studios Home Entertainment. It's also streaming on Peacock in the US and available to rent and buy on various VOD services. You can find me on Blue Sky at Norm Wilner, and you can find this podcast there at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at someoneelsesmovie.com. The first year of the show is still available for just $20 at payhip.com/Semcast. That's the first 52 episodes of Someone Else's Movie, 44 of which aren't currently available anywhere else. And check out my newsletter, Shiny Things, at shiny-things.ghost.io. I think you'll enjoy it. Our theme song is by The Last Year. If you like it, or the show in general, please say so. Leave a review wherever you've been listening. Every little bit helps. It truly does. And check out the other shows on the Frequency Podcast Network while you're doing that. Stay safe, watch movies, Wear a mask if you go out. Get the new booster when you can. I'll see you next week.